Welcome to KMXT's Talk of the Rock, our local community affairs program, where we explore issues and organizations related to our community. Talk of the Rock is hosted by members of the KMXT news team.
You're tuned in to Talk of the Rock here on KMXT. I'm your host, Davis Hovey, and today's conversation is pre-recorded from late January, focused on pollock fisheries in Alaska. We'll be discussing how the Gulf of Alaska pollock fishery and the separate Bering Sea Aleutian Island pollock fishery operate, but we'll also talk about the science and the technology that's being used to improve these fisheries. So I'll let my two guests introduce themselves.
Yep, my name is Chelsea Riddell, and I sit on the steering committee for the Alaska Pollock Fisheries Alliance, and I'm a fisheries policy specialist.
Thank you. And Hunter, same thing.
Sure. My name is Hunter Burns. I'm the general manager of Bering North. I also sit on the steering committee for the Alaska Pollock Fishery Alliance.
So you're both here, obviously, representing sort of different perspectives or different fisheries, I guess I'll start with. Chelsea, maybe you could just give us a general overview of how the Gulf of Alaska pollock trawl fishery operates. And then Hunter, I'll come to you and talk about the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands fishery as well.
The Gulf of Alaska pollock trawl fishery still operates as a race for fish. So it's a little bit different than you'll hear about the Bering Sea fishery. So we still have a race for fish. And in order to have any sort of management, the fleet has to agree to like voluntary agreements in order to manage the fishery. So we have a lot more collaboration between vessels trying to figure out how to manage the self-manage the fishery instead of having a really formal structure.
Anything late about quotas or?
Yeah, so the quotas, NIMS sets, well, the council sets the tax, NIMS issues the tax, they open the fishery, so there's, you know, enough quota, it just opens on January 20th. But typically since 2021 was the first year, the fleet has always come to an agreement to stand down until early February. So A season opens on January 20th. They'll go to Prince William Sound or the West Yakutat fishery. And then on February 10th this year, they'll start fishing in the central Gulf of Alaska. And so that stand down is really to avoid salmon bycatch, because bycatch rates can be really high. There's a lot of lightning strikes in that first couple weeks of the fishery in the central Gulf.
Okay, we'll come back to that point too. Was there anything else you wanted to highlight about just Gulf of Alaska pollock trawl fishery operations? I mean, like with observers or electronic monitoring, anything like that?
Yeah, so the monitoring for the Gulf of Alaska trawl fishery, it's definitely a big misconception that there's no monitoring. So in 2025, the agency finally, after several years of practice and collaboration and exemptive fishing permit, implemented the trawl electronic monitoring program in the Gulf of Alaska. Each vessels have to volunteer to opt in on an annual basis. So for 2026, all but one active pollock trawl catcher vessel in the entire Gulf of Alaska is operating under the Trawl EM program. And so for all pelagic pollock trips, they have cameras on for 100% of their trips. And then there is observers shoreside at the processing plants, and they are taking salmon census counts on every single Trawl EM delivery, and then taking other samples on every third delivery, like otoliths and things. And so that's a pretty big difference. On non-pelagic trips, then vessels are still in what's called the partial coverage pool. And so each year, the observer program, based on the budget, sets the coverage rate for partial coverage fisheries in the annual deployment plan. So they can be selected for an observer on those trips.
Okay. Got it. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Hunter, I'm going to go to you now. Could you kind of give a similar overview and summary of the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands pollock trawl fishery and how it operates?
Sure. The Bering Sea Aleutian Island pollock fishery is the largest food fishery in the world, second largest fishery in the world. It is managed under strict allocations. This year, there's 1.375 million metric tons of pollock that is allocated out to community development groups, the catcher processor sector, the mothership sector, and the inshore sector. My vessels are part of the inshore sector. We harvest roughly about 10% of the pollock fishery. The inshore sector is further separated into vessel cooperatives. These vessels have longstanding business relationships with different processors that are found in different communities in on the Aleutian chain. They are organized under a catch share system effectively, and so we don't have that race for fish that the Gulf of Alaska has. It's really rooted in cooperative management. This allows us to have individual vessel accountability, have a slower pace of the fishery. We're allowed to we have certain responsibilities, of course, that come with having secure allocations. Those responsibilities include things like salmon avoidance plans, caps on being able to participate in most other fisheries within the state of Alaska. So the pollock fishery in the Bering Sea is managed under strict salmon bycatch limits as well, Chinook salmon bycatch limits, as well as strict herring bycatch limits.
And could you talk a little bit about the observer coverage and electronic monitoring for that fishery?
For catcher vessels that deliver shoreside, their observer coverage is all electronic monitoring. This means that there are a bunch of cameras found on all of in various places on a vessel that really they lock into and are monitoring a fishing vessel or fishing vessels 24 hours a day. The moment they leave the dock, those cameras are on, out to the steaming out to the grounds. They're on. They capture all fishing activity. We're a 100% retention fishery, so everything that comes on board, we have to put down into our tanks. And so it was developed to take the place of human observers, which we were also transitioned into a regulatory regime or a regulatory program in 2025 after years of testing and collaborating to make it a feasible and functioning program. So the catcher processor sector, they still have human observers 24 hours a day. They are counting all the fish that are dumped out of the caught end. They're counting all the salmon that are potentially caught in each tow.
So I'm going to pick up there with the salmon bycatch topic, because I know a lot of folks talk about that when they talk about the pollock trawl fisheries. So obviously, just to say up front, you know, we're all three of us here in this room, we're all aware that salmon bycatch does happen, right? I mean, it's seemingly impossible, I guess, to avoid 100% of salmon 100% of the time, right? Like it happens. But from what you both have described and some of the changes, I guess I'll say, that's been made in the last few years regarding electronic monitoring and observer coverage, it seems like maybe the amount of salmon bycatch has been reduced. Could you kind of talk more about that in your respective expertise or fisheries?
Yeah, I can go first. So the biggest improvement for the Gulf is that we now have 100% census on our trips of salmon accounting. So until 2025, prior to 2025, you know, we were in the partial coverage category. And even when we were in the exempted fishing permit, part of the development of the EFP program, we had the observers would only count salmon on every third delivery because we were a partial coverage fishery. And then on human observed trips, when they were selected for an observer, they would have a census count of salmon. But there wasn't 100% accounting on every single trip, because basically if there's not a camera at sea or a human observer at sea, you can't guarantee that that number is even accurate. So the sampling rates are set by the observer program every year in the annual deployment plan. And so for a couple different reasons, they decided to change the sampling for shoreside observers in the Gulf so that every single EM delivery has a full census count. And that's really important to understand, because in 2024, when we exceeded the salmon cap, that was still not a full census on every trip. And so in reality, those two bad toes on the two boats side by side caught about 2,000 salmon, which is still horrific, still horrible. But based on the extrapolations and the way sampled data extrapolates to unsampled trips, 2,000 salmon turned into 12,000 salmon and hit the cap and closed the fishery. And so what this does for the Gulf numbers is it just gives more certainty and accuracy, because the majority of the pollock is harvested in the EM program now. And so we have a true census on those counts. So we know that the number is the number. And the cameras, like Hunter said, are on 24/7. If someone tried to discard salmon, you can tell on the camera. So yeah, it's a lot more certainty in our Gulf numbers now.
Okay. Similar question to you, Hunter, on the Bering Sea, Aleutian Island side. When we're talking about salmon bycatch, how some recent changes have maybe helped reduce salmon bycatch in recent years?
So in the Bering Sea, there are really two species of salmon that our vessels encounter, Chinook salmon and chum salmon. I'll start with Chinook. Chinook are largely found year-round in the A season. We see a higher incidence of Chinook in the A season. That's the main salmon that we're trying to avoid. We have a salmon incentive plan agreement across all the shoreside cooperatives. All the sectors are required to have an incentive plan agreement in order to access a higher Chinook PSE cap limit. And the incentive plan, it's a contractual agreement among all of the cooperatives, and it has very stiff penalties for vessels that violate that contract. So it's not a voluntary plan. This is required to prosecute our fishery. And the elements of those, the first element would be that the more that we avoid Chinook salmon, the more that we are able to ensure that down the road when and if there is a higher abundance of Chinook around, we're still able to prosecute our fishery. The other, and I think really important critical component of our incentive plan, is the rolling hotspot program. So we're monitored by an entity called Sea State. And what they do is they tabulate all of the pollock pounds and all of the Chinook that are counted in our census counts at the plant. And rates that exceed a certain threshold in certain areas, they make the decision independently to close those areas off to fishing vessels that exceeded that rate. And that moves the fleet away from higher incidence of Chinook into different areas in the Bering Sea. And it incentivizes our vessels to remain clean, because they want to be able to prosecute their allocations without being limited or pushed out of certain areas where there may be good pollock fishing. So that is in place during the A season. And then again, later on in the B season, which starts June 10th. The other salmon species that we encounter are chum salmon. So this is a really big topic right now. The difficulty is that over 80% of chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea is non-Alaskan. So their task is to evaluate the data, evaluate their management options to help the pollock fleet avoid a Western Alaska chum salmon bycatch. Right now we have in place, we are testing with in-season genetic testing that is almost real time. When we make a landing a couple days after the harvest, they're there sampling the chum salmon, taking it back to their lab in Dutch Harbor and reporting out pretty rapidly on a weekly basis what the composition of that chum salmon bycatch is.
And then, Hunter, you mentioned the in-season genetic testing for chum salmon. Is that relatively new? Was that instituted within the last year or 2 years or so?
Yeah, in the last couple of years, BVSRI has been testing out this real-time in-season genetic testing to see if it could be useful for in-season management under our cooperative structure.
Okay, understood. And just one more clarification on the hotspots. You mentioned the rolling hotspots and how if those are discovered for salmon in the fishing grounds, that I guess, did you say sea state is the one that makes the decision then to the pollock fleet to say, hey, stand down in this area, don't fish in this area?
Yeah, they send out weekly and sometimes biweekly closure area notices where they've closed off areas for time and space, and these are 500 to 1,000 mile area square mile closures, and their intent is to move the fleet away from areas where we've encountered high Chinook, or and also there is a rolling hotspot program in place for chum salmon encounters that we have instituted voluntarily and also part of the Amendment 110 package that was passed several years ago through the council.
Appreciate that. Thank you. I'm going to stick with you, Hunter, for this next question. I'd like to talk about the pelagic trawl gear. I know this is another big topic that folks like to discuss. There's, still an ongoing debate about whether trawl gear makes contact with the seafloor or not. Obviously, it's supposed to be more midwater trawl gear, but it seems like seafloor contact can happen, and folks are debating whether or not, how much of, an impact that's having on the ecosystem. So how would you sort of characterize and describe the pelagic trawl gear, and how would you say maybe that gear is being improved or its impact is being reduced?
It isn't in question that the nets do occasionally touch the bottom. I think as you said, the question is, what is the impact? And so the industry has partnered with Alaska Pacific University to conduct a modeling exercise study to evaluate what the actual impacts of our nets are on the benthic habitat. I think it's worth noting that the areas where we fish in maybe 5% of the Bering Sea shelf. The National Marine Fisheries Service has already, and for several decades, indicated that pollock nets have a temporary and minimal impact on the seafloor.
So then the purpose of the Alaska Pacific University study, as you said, is to sort of get a model on the impact, but you're still saying, pretty confidently that the impact on the ecosystem is minimal at this point from pelagic trawl gear.
I think our effort is to, is designed to, improve our understanding of pelagic, trawl impacts on the seafloor, but currently the best available science says that the impacts are temporary and minimal.
Okay, and Chelsea, your turn.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add in, so the study that Hunter is referencing that says that the impacts are no more than temporary and minimal, that is the essential fish habitat. Part of the fishery management plan for both the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska. So the Magnuson-Stevens Act requires that councils make do an essential fish habitat assessment. It's updated every 5 years. And so the assessments that we have, that's the current data. And then the APU project, when that is finished, the bottom contact estimates from that study will go into the new EFH model, and then we'll have even more updated models. So that work is, it's really cool to note that almost all but one vessel and the entire Bering Sea and Gulf, family-owned and operated catcher vessels from here to Sandpoint and King Cove, and then all catcher vessels and catcher processors in the Bering Sea have all volunteered all of their data and information, and it's really a very fine detail. For all of their different nets, the different weights they use, how they fish their gear. There's captain interviews. So it's going to be a really comprehensive, like the most up-to-date of any gear, any fishery, right? Like all fishing gear has some sort of impact in the water. And so, yeah, it's a really cool study that fishermen have willingly volunteered this information to do.
Yeah, no, I think it really speaks to just how forward-thinking these catcher vessels are. The fishermen are, they're constantly trying to innovate. Fisheries management is so complex. And one of the challenges is if you push in one place, what happens in other areas? No one, I think, in 1994, when they implemented the IFQ program for halibut and black cod, could have envisioned that orcas and sperm whales would learn how to pick long lines clean when they're pulling them up. But that's an example of changing the fisheries management structure and having unintended consequences. So now you see a lot of longliners have moved to slinky pots or pots for black cod, and that's to protect the black cod that they're harvesting. Well, trawl fishermen are no different. They see that there's an impact, or they see that, we're under constraints on salmon bycatch. Let's develop excluders. Let's test those excluders scientifically. We've been part of several experimental fishery permits to test the efficacy of chum salmon and Chinook salmon excluders in the Bering Sea. And that work continues, and it's going to be ongoing and for all gear aspects.
Well, you segued right into my next question, Hunter. I appreciate that. I was going to ask about some of the new technology that's being deployed. So, yeah, the salmon excluder is certainly one. I understand, there are certain video cameras. I forget if they're called Sexton cameras or something like that. But they use AI and other models to detect salmon and pollock nets. Could you maybe talk a little bit about some of that technology that's being tested and used at this point, and how you think that's maybe helping reduce salmon bycatch?
Sure. There's a lot of different innovations going on. Wireless sensors on the net that show how the net is operating within the water column. I think one of the key goals for every pollock fisherman is to catch fish in as short amount of time as possible. And catching the fish faster generally means that we have the net in the water longer, and we have less probability that we're going to run into a bycatch species. So we really work from there to make ourselves really efficient. There are also people who are deploying real-time cameras. They're called fork wires, or they go by a few different names. They are effectively a camera that is attached to a certain part of the net that illuminates an area where the fish are moving into from the front of the net into the intermediate and into the cod end. And the captain can monitor that camera and is able to say, oh, hey, there's good pollock, clean pollock in here. There's no other bycatch species, and they're able to fish knowing or having a good understanding of what is going into their net. Now, those are relatively new, and they're in the hundreds of thousands of dollars oftentimes. So those are currently being deployed throughout several fleets in the Bering Sea. But they also require someone to be looking at them 100% of the time that the net's in the water. So to my knowledge, we haven't seen any significant movements in the AI field deployed into the Bering Sea. SIMRAD has also been working on things like active excluders, where you're able to wirelessly move a gate in the net to prevent bycatch species from going into the caught in. So there's a bunch of different fronts on that are being investigated right now.
Okay. Same question on the technology front for Gulf of Alaska pollock trawl.
Yeah, so the Gulf of Alaska, we are also innovating gear. I think one thing to note is that fishermen, kind of as Hunter alluded to, fishermen have been innovating their gear for a long time because they're always trying to fish better, more efficiently, more cleanly. In the Gulf of Alaska, our habitat is a lot more rocky than it is in the Bering Sea. There's some sandy areas that boats fish, but you really want to know exactly what your net is doing in the water because there's so many ways to lose gear, and gear is very expensive, not even just the cameras that Hunter was talking about. And so people are always trying new gear designs. There's net cameras that you can put on that actually they're not live feed. You can take them off. And then you upload the video so you can see how your net was fishing as you make adjustments and fine tune it. And there are a few boats that have the live feed cameras that fish in the Gulf. But as Hunter said, it's just really cost prohibitive for most fishermen. So compared to the Bering Sea, the Gulf fleet is primarily predominantly independently owned family catcher vessels. And so making hundreds of thousands of dollars in investment by the time you buy the camera and the fourth wire and an extra winch to use that net camera. It's just a lot more, especially with how poor the markets have been the last few years. You know, everyone in all fisheries is struggling. So
what about collaborations or assistance from like NOAA, right? When they're doing research purposes, when they're using this technology for research purposes and trying to get a better understanding of the models, right? Are they partnering with fishermen in the Gulf of Alaska to say, hey, like, we would love for you to just host this technology on board?
Yeah, so that's another good question. So NOAA used to actually have a bycatch reduction person on staff. I think they had a couple different people at different times, but they don't actually have someone that is working on gear right now. They don't have a scientific expert that's helping collaborate with fishermen anymore. So that's why the whole trawl fleet got together to created this gear innovation initiative to get all of our fleets together to give all that information to work with APU and Dr. Brad Harris, because there's not really anyone. So there's probably some grant opportunities, but again, you also have to have the staff capacity to really find those grant opportunities. And with a single net, like, a lot of grants aren't just going to give a fisherman, like, you know, a $200,000 grant just to get, you know, there's a lot of challenge to it. So we did get NIFWIF grants when we were implementing electronic monitoring to help pay for those costs of implementing that. But gear is just a little more challenging, and the cost per vessel are a lot steeper.
When is that APU study supposed to start? Is that this summer?
It's already started. It's already underway. So yeah, it has been underway for over a year, and I can speak for the Gulf. They're just finishing a lot of the fishermen interviews, so they turned in all of the data, and they're just finishing up the last few people that were harder to get a hold of to do those in-person interviews with the grad student that's working on it. So it's pretty impressive that over 60 fishermen just in the Gulf alone have all had like one-on-one conversations and answered questions about how their gear has operated.
And that'll do it for today's Talk of the Rock. Thanks again to my guests, Chelsea Riddell and Hunter Burns, for discussing pollock fisheries with me. Have a great day, and thanks for listening to KMXT.